And Moses Shakespeare from the MC.
My name is Moses Free. I'm from Limpopo. I'm part of the Portfolio Committee on Communications and Public Enterprises. Thanks.
From the
Natasha Michael from the DA.
My name is Khoto, surname is Morapela from Free State, representing EFF.
My name is Geli Nobanda from the Northwest, representing ANC.
Haven Singh from the IFT.
My name is David Nkumanda from the Department of Public Enterprises.
Good afternoon. My name is Will Tyler from the Department of Public Enterprises.
Dina Sharissa from the Department of Public Enterprises.
Good afternoon. My name is Mpuyo Makatini, also from the Department of Public Enterprises.
Good afternoon, Yoni Somakasi from the Department of Public Enterprises.
Hi, I'm Lee Bramwell. I'm a parliamentary researcher.
Sidiso Maduna, Director General of Public Enterprises.
Good afternoon, Rodney Mnisi. Colleague advisor to the committee.
I'm Zukile Luyenge, a member of the ANC and a member of the National Assembly, in particular this committee. Sorry for coming late.
From the PNG.
I'm Giovanni Matera, CLO from the Office of the Deputy Minister of African
Affairs. From
Thank you.
I'm responsible for strategic planning, monitoring, and evaluation in public enterprises. It is the Director General. The minute they step out there, the first one, CEO, I've been hammered in the committee. Where are you? Why was this not right and all that? So, Honorable I don't want to pronounce his name wrong. Morapela. Morapela.
It's become
the longer we will be in the committee, I'll get it right. If I forgot it, I'll just say my honorable comrade EFF, we have been joined by a very important person. We would just like her to introduce herself, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Rukiswa Ranjo from Eastern Cape. I am representing ANC in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ranjo. Honorable members, we've got a department here led by the Director General. The Director General is also a very old customer. Client and a very good hand at what he's doing. I've known him for quite some time. We've served on various economic committees and clusters and that. So it's a man that knows his story and so does his staff. Director General, 80% of the members of the committee are new. We've got a few new members of parliament. But the others are old hands at Parliament, and Honorable Michaels is part of the, I wouldn't say the staff component, but this is part of the, nearly part of the establishment of the committee. Honorable Marupera is a new member. Honorable Nobanda is new in Parliament. Honorable Singh has been here in 94, was part of the establishment then, and he ran away to KZN, and then he decided Cape Town is better than Durban. I always argue with him about Cape Town is better than Durban, and he agrees with me, that's why he's back in Parliament again. Honorable Tele is a new member. Honorable Luenge is a returning member. Honorable Sele is a returning member. Honorable Ranto is new in this committee, new in the NA, was in the NCOP before, and also quite experienced, part of the parliamentary institution as well, myself, was in the NCOP, now in the NA, so we are all part of the, I won't say old establishment, but establishment. And then the competent and able staff, our researcher, content advisor, and the committee secretary. You know them, they have been working with this committee for some time now. This is the committee, the chairperson. We have to apologize, she is abroad on other duties. So that's why I'm only for today. I'm sharing I'm sitting in the hot seat, the powerful hot seat. And then our CLOs, on behalf of the minister and the deputy minister, again, to make the apology because, as I've explained to the members, that cabinet take president over all other work in parliament. And there's no way that you can tell the president, sorry, I'm going down to parliament and tell you, stay there. Stay there. Don't worry. Tonight will just be on SABC News. Cabinet reshuffle, there's an announcement made. So cabinet takes precedence. So we excuse the minister and the deputy minister. PLOs, please report to them that the apology has been accepted. And we note, and we will definitely, we are not in much in a hurry, we'll definitely know that they won't neglect the committee to come with the committee. But, the state of the nation was, it is now budgets, where they must go and explain
also to cabinet and cabinet committees about the rollout of SONA and all that. So with that, DG, let me stop there and over to you to take us through the presentation. Thank you, DG.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ferry Adams. Thank you very much for being in the position of chair. I just want to say on behalf of the department, firstly to congratulate all of you members of the 5th Democratic Parliament. I'd like to congratulate you for your appointment into the very important roles on behalf of the people of South Africa. We, as a department, have had a very good relationship with Parliament because we understand what the role of Parliament is in our government, and so we value the advice, the guidance that Parliament provides over the in its oversight of the work of the executive. So we understand that. We understand that when we get the blows that the chair was talking about, the intention is to build. The intention is to ensure that we improve in the work that we do as such. So I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate you. The presentation I'm going to make is a summary at a very high level of the documents that we tabled last Friday, which is the strategic plan for the next 5 years and the annual performance plan, 5-year annual performance plan, that is intended to be the implementation plan for our strategy. The outline of the presentation is as indicated. I'll make some introductory remarks. I'll give a sense of how we've organized our work as a department, the structure of the department. We will locate our work within the current strategic context that speaks to the environment that we would like to impact upon in the work that we do. We will reflect on the vision and the mission that guides our work, and then I will get into the key interventions that we're proposing to be undertaking in the period ahead. And then we will look at the budget of the department. We will look at the resources of the department in terms of human resources especially. I've included a slide which should not really require too much focus. It can just be used as a kind of a reference point to how we see our strengths, our weaknesses, and the opportunities that face us and the threats that face us in terms of our work, and we'll conclude the presentation. The tabling of a strategic plan to Parliament is a special requirement. It's in terms of the law, and so we are doing this in compliance of the law. The content of it obviously is framed by the Medium-Term Strategic Framework, which is the government plan which the cabinet has adopted at its first quarter, which is a strategic planning session of the cabinet in this new administration. They adopted this MTSF. But of course, the work on the MTSF comes a long way we've been contributing to this process since last year. And so if adoption by cabinet is a culmination of work that's been going on for a very long time. I might just say in passing that we are comfortable about the alignment of what we are proposing to do with the priorities and the targets that are included in the strategic framework of the medium-term strategic framework. We conceived the strategy guided by a certain set of principles. The alignment with the overarching policy documents of government referred to the medium-term strategic framework, but there are other strategic and policy documents of government. The new growth path is one of them, the industrial policy action plan is another. And of course, various policies, legislation, that we must always ensure that we are consistent with. And in fact, we help to achieve those policies and objectives. We also wanted to be very clear about what are the specific outcomes we will achieve. So we try to be very specific, very concrete in terms of what we propose to be doing over the next 5 years. We are obviously alive to the current economic environment, an economy that's slowing down, impacted upon by the global economy, which is itself going through a slowdown. And you'll see this impacts the work of the companies that the department is responsible for. Most of the things that we have to do as a department require that we work with other government departments. And so the idea of coordination across government, integration, identifying those things that can have an enhanced impact because they entail or they require more than one department, is also something that informs how we conceive the strategy. We were able to present it rather quickly to the minister because there was initially no clarity as to when is it going to be required. Do we have time to take the minister through it in detail and so on? But we were able to at least let her have a sense of what the documents contain. And for that reason, she was able to approve, as you have seen in the documents that we submitted last week, to say that we can pay. Now that we are here, really the focus is going to be on the implementation of the actions that we've identified. Just to give a description of the department, the mandate of the department is to be the shareholder through the minister. To be the shareholder representative for government in 8 state-owned companies, which are Eskom, responsible for electricity, Dinel, responsible for defense, manufactured defense products, Subcol, forestry, broadband Infraco, the expansion of broadband infrastructure in the country, Alasco, the diamond mining company, Transnet, rail and port and transport logistics company, and the two companies in the aviation sector, SAA and South African Express. The mandate of the department is embedded in the founding legislation. Several of these companies actually have founding legislation. In fact, I think it's only Dinel that does not have founding legislation, but all these companies are based, have their own legislation, which partly frames what we do. But there's also the Public Finance Management Act that also frames and guides what we do as a department. I'll mention in passing, because we can come back to this, the fact that there is no integrated cross-cutting legislation in the country that defines shareholder representation or state ownership, as it were. The Presidential Review Commission on State-Owned Companies that was conducted recent years, the last 2-3 years or so, proposed in one of its recommendations that the state should consider an act, an overarching act that defines state-owned companies and can therefore standardize how we govern them, how we direct them, how we fund them, as it were, because at the moment state-owned companies are scattered in different departments and have different practices in regard to the exercise of oversight over these companies. The mandate is to ensure that these companies serve government strategic objectives and are aligned with the priorities outlined in the National Development Plan, as well as the New Growth Path and Industrial Policy Setting Plan, as I've mentioned. We've organized our work in terms of three overarching programs. Within each program, there's clearly sub-programs, as it were, that detail out the different sectors and the different focus areas in each program. Program one is headed, in fact, by TDG Corporate Management, and the COO is intended to provide strategic management, corporate management, and administrative support to the department, which enables us the different professionals enables them to do their work in pursuit of our strategic objectives. It's responsible for systems, plans, and processes, monitoring and evaluation, as was indicated. That has related to governance, finance, information technology systems, facilities, audit, the audit function, all of that in this program. A very important program that creates an enabling environment for the rest of the staff of the department to do their work. Legal and governance provides legal services and corporate governance systems and standards, and facilitates the implementation of all legal aspects of transactions that are strategically important to the department and the state-owned companies. It also ensures alignment with the government strategic intent for each company by monitoring key risk factors that face each company, and that may affect the achievement of key performance indicators contained in the shareholders' portfolio management and strategic partnership. This is where the different teams, sector teams across the company, energy, transport, broadband, and other companies. So each of these companies is overseen by a team of professionals that help with monitoring, analyzing the business of the environment, the threats, the risks, and advising the minister accordingly with regard to interventions or decisions that the minister may need to marketing programs, one called strategic partnerships, to begin to think through how we may want to overcome the financial constraints that the companies confront. More is expected with time, more is expected. The expectations of government in terms of these companies are growing. And this is sometimes undermined by their financial capabilities or the resources that they require, and we need to start to think about innovative ways of addressing them. Economic impact and policy alignment is really intended to enable us to assess at any given point in time what the real impact of these companies are in the economy, in accordance with the priorities of government, job creation, skills development, and overall growth of the economy. This is a high level organogram. We have Minister, Deputy Minister. I report to the Minister as an accounting officer, head of department, and underneath me, in each of the blocks, deputy directors general, who are responsible for the management of the programs and the activities, as I just outlined. I might just indicate, Chair, that my intention was to have all the deputy DGs here. It being the first meeting of the committee, I did not succeed. Some of them were required to, by the minister, to do other assignments. So I'd like to apologize on their behalf. And one of them is actually on sick leave as we speak. But because we will be regularly coming here to brief you or report to you on various things, we will have an opportunity to meet those DDGs. 7 of them, 5 of the DDGs are women, so it's a majority women EXCO, executive committee of the department. We're very proud of that. We endeavor to pursue and achieve the target of 50 gender representation in the department, and I think that the leadership that must be reflected in the leadership of the department. I agree with you, Chair. The strategic context speaks to the environment, the current environment, the economic environment. We see that the economy has been very constrained over the past 5 years. This is an economy that is performing far below its potential, partly as a result of the external environment, the adverse external global environment, partly as a result of internal constraints. And in terms of those constraints, the companies and the department, some of them can unblock the constraints, or they can themselves be in fact the source of the constraints, as it were. We know that the shortage of electricity is a major factor that is constraining growth of the economy. And that puts ESCOM and what ESCOM does in the spotlight. Similarly, concerned with regard to rail capacity that's preventing investment in the mining sector, and general inefficiencies in our logistics system that is also contributing to growth. So we have a constrained economic environment. We know what the problems are. We know what the causes of some of the challenges are, and the work outlined in the medium-term strategic framework seeks to address precisely those constraints And our work and our strategic plan is intended to feed into that. I put a graph there that shows you the relative importance of investment in the economy by government, partly directly, partly through state owned companies relative to the private sector. There is a symbiotic relationship between investment by government and investment by the private sector. In the circumstances, really, government is the investor of last resort. And government, if it does things properly and if it does things well, can stimulate private sector investment, which we require to achieve the rate of growth that will help us to overcome unemployment, inequality, and poverty. The vision of the department is a fairly recent vision. It seeks to emphasize outcomes from the shareholder oversight function that we are responsible for. Typically, the department defined its vision and its responsibilities in very passive terms, referring just to the exercise of shareholder oversight. In this vision, we seek to define, if you like, the outcomes. What must that shareholder oversight result in? What must we get out of that? And so we speak of promoting investment, promoting productivity, promoting transformation, in order to drive growth of the economy, and to drive industrialization and create jobs as well as develop skills. So all of the things that we do are guided by this vision and seek to realize these outcomes. I've indicated there what the key outcomes that we are pursuing are industrialization, transformation, regional development, which speaks to our links and relationships with our neighborhood, our regional neighborhood in the African continent. We have identified six strategic objectives, the first being to review shareholder oversight. Shareholder oversight is not a static thing. It evolves, influenced by a variety of factors. So we need to be always looking at how we improve the exercise of shareholder government. The promotion of good corporate governance within the department and in the companies, to build our capacities as a department, to stabilize the companies looking at their balance sheets and funding options, to look at how we direct the companies to invest in infrastructure, critical infrastructure, as I've referred, as well as leveraging their procurement. They procure fairly massively, spending huge amounts of money in their capital programs that can be harnessed to support industrialization and transformation. This speaks to the value chain of our implementation. We have the strategic objectives that have been agreed, which are supported by specific interventions, the projects that we will be undertaking, which are supported by coordination, monitoring and evaluation. This speaks to the value chain of the strategy and the value propositions that are contained in the strategy. To get into the how we propose to achieve the strategic objectives, with regard to the first one of shareholder oversight, we would like to return rather to the Presidential Review Commission of State-Owned Companies has been concluded and advocates or recommends the creation of overarching shareholder legislation. We would like to go back to that work which the department had undertaken some years back, but was abandoned, to streamline the exercise of shareholder oversight and standardize all the practices that are associated with that corporate governance setup. To review what we call the logical planning, monitoring, and evaluation framework. This is a set of actions that the department undertake to cascade the high-level strategic objectives of government into the strategic intent for each company, which spells out all of the things that the shareholder expects that company to achieve, which also speaks to governance issues, and then cascading down to the shareholder compact, and then from the shareholder compact to the corporate plan, which will implement all of the actions and initiatives that we expect the companies to undertake in pursuit of the priorities of government. We also have an instrument that allows us to have real-time view of performance of the companies, the dashboard, which is populated by the companies on an ongoing basis, so we can see and identify risks as they emerge in the work of the companies. Good, promoting good corporate governance with an emphasis on compliance with the legislation. The PFMA is a very, very key issue. These companies come from the past where they had very little regard to accountability, and the accountability standards especially that are contained in the PFMA, but also compliance with other legislation that impacts on them, like the Companies Act. To look at improving our business processes as a department, to ensure that the control environment, we have the appropriate controls in the department to allow us to comply, but also to be a lot more outward looking, to promote accountability and interface with the public, as it were. These companies impact on communities, impact on society, and they need to engage with society so they can take on board the concerns of the people on which they impact. For example, in provinces, the activities of the companies are sometimes the main show in town, as it were, you know, through the infrastructure rollout. You know. If you look at, for example, the project in Limpopo to build a power station, the Midupi, it is a single project that underpins the economy of the region and provides the greatest employment in that province. Or Kusile in Mpumalanga, and so on and so forth. So their activities should dovetail with the strategies of provinces to grow the provincial economies and address social economic challenges as such. Speaking about the department's capacities, our human resource plan will prioritize the recruitment, development, and retention of skills. The nature of the department is a professional services type of organization. So the skills we depend on are highly sought after. And they're highly mobile skills, as it were. So we are challenged to create an environment in which our professionals can stay within the department and help us to achieve our objectives, as it were. So this speaks to creating an attractive environment so we can attract additional skills and retain those that are in the department. But this is also where we seek, in terms of what we do, to promote excellence, to promote the highest standards of performance, to ensure that we foster a high performance culture that must be evidenced by the results of our work and the outcomes from our work. Objective four: stabilizing state-owned companies, looking at particularly financial sustainability. A few of our companies in financial distress as we speak, particularly the companies in the aviation sector. And I'm sure there will be interest in the meeting on some of the issues confronting our companies in the aviation sector, South African Airways and South African Express. But we're also seeing a company like Eskom also confronting emerging financial constraints as such. Elsewhere in Subcall and Alexco, it is to reposition those companies so that they can identify additional revenue streams. Subcall being a timber producing company is very critical to the growth of the furniture industry. And so some of the changes that we require, the shifts that we require, is that they focus on the value chain that can supply the furniture industry and thereby create opportunities for employment. But they're also very much tied up with the land claims. Subcall and Alasco operate in areas where there are land claims, some of them which have been successfully settled, others which are still pending. The point being that these two companies again can make a critical impact on communities as agents of development, as it were, rather than narrowly understood as enterprises, business enterprises as such. So we're looking at addressing these issues of how we model and reposition these companies. Objective five speaks to the infrastructure investment, which is a critical priority of government in the framework of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordination Committee. And it speaks in particular to electricity infrastructure, as well as rail and ports and logistics infrastructure, which are the responsibility of Eskom and Transnet, which are probably the leading state-owned companies in the land, as it were, with regard to the magnitude of their influence in the economy. They are undertaking capital programs right now, which we want to ensure are delivered expeditiously, especially because in the area of electricity, we've had delays which are impacting negatively on the economy. The reason why we are having load shedding is because the new capacity, the electricity supply capacity, has not come on hand in time. And if these delays are not overcome, load shedding is going to be a regular feature of our lives as such. We might just provide an update, for example, with regard to Medupi, which has been very much in the news, that the factors that were associated with the delays historically have all but been resolved. They've been resolved, and so the timelines that were announced, we are on course to achieving those timelines, which is to conclude the first unit of the power station by end of this year. However, against that background, I must say, as I saw in the newspapers this morning, that the resurgence of labor unrest is a matter of very deep concern for us. The country cannot afford industrial destabilization that is going to impact on our ability to keep the lights on in the middle of an economy that is already under distress, as it were. So this is a matter that is going to require that we find ways decisively to ensure that we bring an end to the destabilization of the project, so that it has not upset the timelines that have been set for it. I think that nobody is going to emerge a winner. We will all be losers if we allow the emerging labor unrest to affect the delivery of electricity from Medupi project. We will all be losers. The Africa strategy speaks to the importance of South Africa building links, infrastructure links, especially with the continent, for the movement of our goods into the African continent, into our regional neighborhood, but also Africa as a source of energy as well. Some of the opportunities for capacity, increased capacity in the energy sector, for example, lie outside of South Africa. You look at Mozambique. Mozambique now has gas reserves, the fourth largest gas reserves in the world, that can significantly alter the trajectory of our economy if we are able to tap into those, or tap into the hydro projects that are in the continent. We are encouraging our companies to be a lot more outward looking, while they focus, prioritize their work on supporting the economy, the domestic economy. They should also be looking at how we cooperate with our neighboring countries. Private sector participation speaks to the need to identify those areas in the work of our companies where the private sector, the private sector can make a contribution as investors, or through some other relationship or partnerships, as it were. We want to be able to monitor these investments effectively, so the project management frameworks and the ability to oversee mega projects is something that has challenged us. It has challenged the companies. Many of them have never done data projects of the sort of scale that they're doing right now. And the challenge is the expertise of managing those projects have sometimes caused the delays in terms of time, but also associated cost overruns and so on. So insofar as going forward, we are going to be building infrastructure for many years to come. We need to be able to execute ourselves differently, I think, going forward. And therefore, we need to build those capacities within government. Procurement spend of our companies is very massive. And so we, in this objective, we are seeking to ensure that the massive investments that they undertake have multiplier effects. They have to stimulate the domestic economy. To the extent possible, they have to source domestically. Because, and I'll put it very simply, if they buy overseas products that they can source domestically, the jobs are created overseas. They're not created here at home. And so we all want to ensure that as they spend these huge amounts, that those are associated with a positive impact on the economy through creating opportunities for additional enterprises and allowing existing enterprises to go up the value chain so they can become competitive suppliers in an international, in a global context. So that speaks to the rail and locomotives, speaks to the acquisition of aircraft and the building of electricity infrastructure. The state-owned companies do quite a lot of things that promote transformation. We need to be more systematic. You know, for example, how they report about BEE, the impact of BEE on enterprise development. So we want to standardize and so we can measure concretely what their contributions are in regard to transformation. This speaks particularly to transformation that includes women in the economy, that includes young people, young entrepreneurs. State-owned companies should focus in unique ways at providing young entrepreneurs with opportunities to enter the economy, to enter business as such. They are starting to do that, but I think the scope to expand these activities and to make sure that they are executed in more effective ways. So we will be looking at how they contribute to addressing the challenges of youth unemployment and youth development. Many of the employees of these companies are young people. State-owned companies often provide the first opportunity for young graduates to get employment and to get training, and then of course they then get poached by private sector company, sometimes through high, very big salaries and so on. The state-owned companies sometimes also, by the way, they poach from the department. They offer these officials more money than I can offer them. And then they put, so sometimes I feel like I'm a permanent recruitment agency. Always have to recruit. Training and skills development is very, very key. I think that if we ensure that young people in massive numbers have got skills that the economy requires. That's the best possible thing that we can do for their empowerment and their future. So this is a big thing. We are working with the Department of Higher Education Training, because that department recognizes the unique contribution that state-owned companies can make in the area of training, especially artisan training, which are skills that are required currently in the economy. They are required in the context particularly of the infrastructure program that we are rolling out. I'm now getting to the end of my presentation with an indication of the budget. You can see it's a fairly small department. Trying to do big things with limited resources. But I think there is a contribution that we can make. I know the Treasury recognizes the importance of the DPE, a capable and effective DPE, because for the Treasury, the state-owned companies are assets. They are also liabilities, so the Treasury pays attention to what goes on in our space. In the time that I've been there, in the last 4 years or so at DPE, have secured modest increases in resources. I think that's the growth, the constraint on the growth of our resources is the economy and fiscal constraint. The Treasury is collecting less and less money, and therefore is unable to meet all the expectations or the requirements for additional resources. This will be with us for a while, and so what it means is that we will have to live within our means. All of these things we will have to try to do within our means. It shows you the modest growth of our budget over the next 5 years, at least the average of 9.9%. That is a staff complement of the department. You will see how we have handled the vacancies, because I can't go to the Treasury and ask for more money to employ more people if I'm keeping lots of vacancies. So we're very proud of how we have brought down the vacancy rate in the department, which end of this financial year, or the last financial year, March 2030, was at 1.8%, having come from as high as 12% in some years, and perhaps even higher. So the long and short is we are almost at the limits of the resources that are at our disposal. This means that we have to have a very high professional ethic. I tell the chief operating officer that my DDGs and the head of HR that this is not the place for loafers, because everybody else works hard. So if you're a loafer, we catch you. You stand out if you're a loafer. Everybody works hard here because our resources are so constrained, as it were. I spoke about the SWOT analysis. I want to spend time on it. I think members can look at it. If there are any issues that we can deal with in that space, we're happy to do so. We conclude by making reference to the State of the Nation address, because in that address, our work has been cut out for us. So the President spoke about the need to accelerate delivery of economic infrastructure and made special reference to ESCOM and the need to support ESCOM as it executes this massive responsibility of keeping the lights on. The President also referred to the National Development Plan as the guiding framework for our work. We have sought to align what our plans in regard to that. All of this is going to challenge our oversight and what we do in terms of oversight and the outcomes of our oversight of the companies. We will make sure that we do a better job of oversight of the capital projects and the mega projects. And we will keep an eye on the resources. Any opportunity that arises for us to get additional resources, we will make sure we avail ourselves of it. Part of it is going to require that we work in new and creative ways with the companies that we are overseeing within the confines of the statutes, obviously. That concludes the presentation. I did want to say, as I welcomed and congratulated the new members of this committee, to say that I'm pleased that there is also experience, the committee has experience, and so it doesn't enable us to pick up from where we left off in the last administration and take further forward the relationship between our department and this committee. I know Honorable Singh, for example, in the context of SCOPA, where I have made a few appearances to account for the sins of others. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Director General. Honorable members, it is now your turn. They have brought us some snacks, but we're not going to break, members, so you must be very quietly, very discreetly. We don't want to hear plates rattling. Come back to your seats and help yourself and eat. Also, the staff are welcome to join us there. Otherwise, we will hold public enterprises for wasteful expenditure if we leave and the plates are full. I recognize Honorable Michaels, Honorable Rantu, Honorable Tilly, Honorable Singh, in that order. Thank you, Honorable Michaels.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, forgive me. I was a little hungry, so I helped myself before you said it before I had to do so. But I trust I was quiet enough. JDP, thanks for being here today. It's always good to get an overview of what's going on. There are a couple of things that I think are very worrying, and I was chatting to some of the colleagues about it outside earlier. And one of them is the Kusile and Madupi deadline that has been set for the end of the year. Now, DG, you know as well as I do that the delays have caused us nothing but embarrassment. And I know that it's not just me that feels that way. I know we all feel that way. I read today that the strike action by NUMSA has caused, out of the 1,800 people that should be working for Murray and Roberts in the boiler of Madupi, only 400 people are at work, and at the Kusile power station, out of 1,300 that should be at work, only 300 people at work. So effectively, operations have shut down. Now, that is going to have an effect on the deadline date, because you know as well as I do, DG, they're working in shifts to try and get those boilers and turbines up and running. And now with work shut down, and you realize that this is actually, it's an illegal strike, because Eskom got an interdict against NUMSA. And they did so under Section 66 of the Labor Relations Act to say that they were providing an essential service. And then the spokesperson of NUMSA today released a statement to say that NUMSA won't be bullied by the Essential Services Clause, and instructed their members to go on strike anyway. So now, A, NUMSA has overruled a court decision, and B, I mean, they're an essential service and they've now gone on strike, so it's a double whammy for Eskom. This at a time that rolling blackouts are effectively happening, because they are effectively happening. So I just want, you said in your talk to us today that the deadline is set for the end of the year. I don't see it happening. I cannot see us reaching that deadline, especially now, unless something dramatic is done in terms of how we handle labour disputes at these two particular stations, because it's really becoming a problem now. And then, DG, something I mentioned earlier before you arrived, and it was in our earlier presentation, something that worried me greatly was towards the end of the fourth parliament, we had the Auditor General come and speak to us, specifically about DPE. And the Auditor General had one big bone of contention, and that was that none of the targets, well, in fact, very few of the targets, it's not fair to say none, but very few of the targets had been met, and in some cases had been missed by up to 98%. Now, that's not on. Especially with state-owned entities, we cannot turn around to the public and say, this department works for you, not when some of those targets were missed by so much. I do realize that you are understaffed. It became, just for everyone else that wasn't on the committee, it became a joke that we were in Hollywood because there were so many acting officials, and I'm very glad that that's being sorted out. So I understand a lot of the background, but we mustn't let that happen again. We can't let South Africa down like that again. It's embarrassing to yourselves in DPE, and it's embarrassing to Parliament, and we don't want that kind of thing hanging over us. And then my last point, Chief. In terms of the review of state-owned entities, when can we, as a portfolio, expect to see some kind of documentation? We were all asked to submit towards it, which we duly did, and I'm very glad that we had an opportunity to be involved in the review process. But there's a lot of talk, DG, and I'm going to be perfectly frank if you don't mind. But there's a lot of talk that in a couple of months, DPE might not exist anymore. That the various organizations are going to go, as I asked you earlier about Broadband Infoco, but that it wouldn't stop there, that we would literally dissolve the Department of Public Enterprises and each one of the entities would go to where they actually kind of belong. Can you just give us some background as to where and how these stories are coming about?
Thank you, Honorable Michael. Honorable Hunter.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I will ask for your indulgence in some of the things, your patience, because you have already said that we are new in this committee. There are things maybe we won't understand the way you understand them. For example,
indulgence granted.
For example, Chairperson, the DG has mentioned the fact that the state must have an act for SOCs on how they should be governed or should operate, or an act that will just be able to maintain order and everything in the SOCs. For how long have they been persuading that, or for how long have you started to think and maybe asking the state or the government or trying to set up that law that will govern this SOC? I'm asking that because some of the things that are happening in these SOCs, it's because they don't have any legislation and they think that they can do whatever they want to do. Nobody will ask them or nobody will make them to account on a certain law. So for how long has it been happening in this department, in this department? Say again, the other question is, on page 10, the on the strategic objective of the department, the DG mentions that there should be stability, or stabilized to... There should be a stability on our SOCs and looking at strengthening and balancing sheets and funding options of those SOCs. With all the legacy report that we have read from the secretary of the committee, he gave us the legacy report
on these on some of these SOEs. Do you think DJ funding them and then not doing what they are supposed to be doing? You fund them every now and again, but they don't have a report back that is acceptable to the department. Is it funding that is necessary in those SOCs, or is it capacity building within those SOCs, or is there a problem with the Department of Public Enterprise with the way of using your own budget? Maybe then you think it's good to give our budget to the SOCs rather than keep it. Same apply to the leverage SOCs recommend spend to support industrialization and any strategy. Do you have any strategy on helping in doing that, in supporting the SOCs in those things? Chapter soon. Also the DG on page 6, I'm not sure if it was here on page 16 or not, but anyway, he spoke of power stations that are being built. The substations, are they enough in our country? Because for me, some of the substations are there, but they're not maintained by Eskom. Eskom is not maintaining them. What needs to be done? Are they enough, or do we have to add more on them, or are we lacking on the maintenance of those that we have around in the country? DJ, you also mentioned the many years that we are going to take in building infrastructure. And you mentioned the relationship that you have with the Department of Education, of Higher Education, in skills development, so as to be able to have people that will work on building, on the engineers and electricians and everybody else that is supposed to be there. You know, DJ, I always have a problem with students put in universities, helped by the department or by the Department of Education giving them bursaries, and they just disappear in thin air. And nobody from the Department of Education to the department that is expecting those skills, nobody has a track record of those students. Do you have a strategy on tracking those students that you need to help us in those SOCs or even in within your department?
Thank you, Honourable Ranto. Members, as I said earlier on, relax. Be yourself. Don't be on the nerves for the DG and the department, please. And the DG and department, don't be on your nerves for the members. Just relax. Take it in your stride. Be yourself. If you are a fighting person, that's fine. Go for it. If you are a lover, that's fine. Go for it. Honorable Feli.
Thanks, Chair. And thanks for the presentation, DG. I'm happy to be part of this committee, doing oversight over a small department which is trying to do big things. A few issues, and DG, some of these issues came up very, very sharply in the morning while we were receiving some of the presentations, budget analysis, and some of the presentations we got earlier. And I'm happy now, starting with the one that you mentioned, that five of your DDGs are women. But perhaps it might also be important for this committee to know exactly at SMS level where are we exactly with regard to this 50-50 setup. That must also talk to the 2% for people with disabilities. Where are we? How are we on course? If we are there, what strategies do we have that we can implore to try and maintain the target if we are there of it. Secondly, the eight entities that we are doing oversight of as a department, DG, to what extent are these entities playing their role with regard to employment, economic growth, assisting us as a government to deal with the issue of unemployment? To what extent are these entities playing their role in that regard? And also there is one other issue that also came out very, very sharply earlier on from the budget analysis. The expected significant increase on spending on consultants, if I'm not mistaken, was almost 19% over the median term. It was, some were saying, justifiable. But what is it that we are planning to do to try and to deal with that kind of a challenge? Because that's also a very serious challenge, DG, that in other instances we have always been complaining about engaging consultants, even on certain things that we can always do in-house as a department. What is it that we are doing? It came out very, very sharply from the presentation we received earlier on. The second last chair is the shareholder agreements that you enter with the eight entities. Perhaps we might also want to be furnished with copies of those agreements as the committee, just to have a feel of what type of agreements are we talking about. And lastly, from your presentation on SWOT analysis, I want to only pick up one weakness that you identified: lack of clarity on roles and responsibilities. And I want to, for obvious reasons, leave the rest. What is it that we, what plan do we have as a department to deal with that particular weakness, which to me is a very serious weakness: lack of clarity on roles and responsibilities. Because if that issue is not clearly addressed, obviously we are likely to have very serious problems going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Sevi. Honorable Singh.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry that I did indicate earlier that I'd like to leave at 3:30 for another appointment, so I may not be here when the response is given, but I want to thank the DG and his department for the presentation. And yes, we've had experiences in SCOPA, but this is a new learning curve for me, understanding what the department does. And as our other honorable colleague has said, you may be a small department, but the responsibility that lies on your shoulders is heavy, because people out there see the Department of Public Enterprises being responsible for the actions and inactions of every state-owned enterprise that's listed. And unfortunately, the law gives you that power. So what we are saying as a committee, you need to crack the whip. Because if you don't crack the whip with these SOCs, then you know, the buck stops with you. I'd just like to know about some of the outstanding issues from the legacy report that Honorable Ranto mentioned. For example, the land issues with SAFCOR, the broadband issue, the AlexCor issue that we spoke about this morning. When can we expect, I know today is just the first of many interactions, but when can we expect something more concrete? I've been looking at your strategic plans, but more concrete in terms of finalizing some of these very long outstanding issues that need to be just put behind, and you know, the department moves on from there. That's the one thing. And then, has there been any thought in the strategic thinking? I know we've got a new minister who I've worked with before, but to semi-privatization of some of these SOCs. You know, SOCs and SOEs become like a swear word in our country, rightly or wrongly. We need capital injection. We know the economy out there, the global outlook is not good. Has there any thought been given to any of these SOCs or SOEs being semi-privatized with injection from the private sector, with the state holding the majority shareholding? Thank you.
Honorable Morabella.
No, thanks, Jefferson. Mine is on three issues. The broadband in Franco, when we're just studying the legacy report, something that comes out very much strongly, it will seem like as the department were failing to actually work together, because the broadband in Franco has been struggling to get an electronic communication service license for quite some time. We said, if I think that the DG must try to actually share with us what might be the problem and how are we going to actually deal with the issue. The second point being that quite often we found that, and it is alleged that already Eskom will be coming to the department for bailouts and all of that. What is it that you put in plan to make sure that the state-owned companies, they become financially viable and they can actually sustain themselves, because that in itself, it actually affects the work that we're supposed to do. The last point being on the remedial actions that we actually put in place. With regard to the very same point that has been raised by Honorable Michaels, if yes, correct. Something that comes up very strong in the very same report, you'll find that constructions, they are not actually following labor pieces of legislation that are there so that they can be able to comply with what is actually expected out of them in terms of labor relations act. And as a result, that thing, it has had the project of Medupi power station, and you'll find that there's a serious labor relations problems, the conflict between the workers, the employers and the employees there, as a result of those legislations that are not taken into consideration by either the employer. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Person, and sorry for doing this to you. Mr. Person, I just wanted to add on one what comrade honorable member has said on the SWOT analysis of the department, the weaknesses. I think DG, take us through all these weaknesses, because if you are going to explain only one weakness, I don't think it's going to be fair to us. Just and the press that you spoke about or you put on this paper, take us to why do you have such weaknesses? Because the shareholder management model that is not finalized. Why is it not finalized? Because it's one of the things that is going to hold us back in everything that we must do. Chair, thanks.
Oh, thank you, honorable members, DG. We are going to allow you to answer. One thing about being a DG, delegated authority is part of the work profile of a DG. DG, we've also asked the management of the committee when the chairperson gets back, that we will have a breakaway, to have a breakaway strategic session. The department can take us through everything. As I said, these are new members. Come 2019, these members want to leave their own legacy behind. If DPE is dissolved, which is on the cards and all that, as we know, there is talks that ESCOM might go to Energy Department, SAA goes to Transport, SA Express, SAFCO goes to the Forestry, but that's only in the air at the moment. But we will then have that strategic session where, you know, you will come with everything. I don't know, Honorable Oranto, whether we should take the dirty linen of prior to us being elected to this committee, or we should take the dirty linen going from the 7th of May onwards. Should we take the dirty linen from 1948 also? But you being part of the management, that is a decision that you will have to take. We will then have to get the train loads, and DG must organize transfer to get the train loads to bring all that dirty linen. But rightly, as the Honorable Member said, we need to be informed. What is this budget date, sir? 11th. On the 11th, which is next week. On the 16th, eh? Oh, okay. It's on the 16th. 23rd of July. So members need to debate from an informed position. And I think the staff should put the request that maybe before that we have another session with the department on specifically on the budget. You know, because the timing has been, as you said, the time has really been our enemy, DG. The elections is the first time that it's been so late in the year. In May, normally in May, Parliament reconvenes, and the new Parliament reconvenes, and after the inauguration of the President, and by now, we would have been far into the process of the briefings of budgets and budget votes and APPs and all that. So I think we need another session, members. If you will agree with me that we approach the chair for another session with the departments where we can, a whole day session, where we can just extract everything. If there's a Gucci t-shirt that's not supposed to be among the Pep Store t-shirt, we must then take it out. You know what I mean? So that when members go and debate, or when members inform their caucuses, the various political party caucuses, that they inform their caucuses from an informed position to say, no, this is what's happening, this is what we think, this is, because members also need to go back to their party caucuses now. Inform their party caucuses, but also get mandates from their party caucuses to say, no, this is what you should put into the budget when you speak and when you debate in it. So I think we definitely need another session of with you before the budget debate. But over to you, DG.
Let me start off on the comments you're making, Chair. And say that and I'm sure Honorable Michaels will affirm this, that this may be a small department, however the issues that we deal with are very intricate, very involved, and they require that we set aside quality time, so we have a quality engagement. What we've done is almost a kind of a helicopter kind of overview of the work. Each of the areas deserves that we go deeper and deeper so we can tackle all of the issues. Then we're working on the same information, we're working on the same data, and we can therefore then assist each other in the course of this.
DG, to break your word there. We have explained this morning to members that this could be a small department, but the entities that report to the department are massive. And their funding does not come from the department directly, but it comes from the fiscus. And we're not talking about 200 million, we're talking about billions. Billions. I mean, Eskom, the 5-year, 50 billion. We are looking at. So, although it's a non-delivery department, service delivery department, but the entities that the department's got oversight over, they must deliver. And if non-delivery is taking place, not taking place, the buck stops with you. To say, but Director General, can you tell us what's happening there, and your department, and your DDGs and all that. You have to field questions and answers. So also what we said, when we call the entities, we will definitely call the department with the entities, you know, so that we can then have a common understanding and a synergy approach of going forward. Sorry, DG, but is.
Yeah, that is a very important point, Chairperson, that you're making, and I fully agree with that approach. You sound like you once worked for the department, Chairperson. The way you're knowledgeable about our environment and the challenges that we confront, I think that certainly will make for an informed engagement between ourselves, I think, as we go forward. I want to deal with the question of the issue of the future of PPE and just put that out of the way. I want to start off by saying that I'm not aware of any communication from the president, from the ANC, or anyone on the closure or the idea that or the proposal that CPE be closed. We have not received any such. We've seen the reconfiguration of government and the extent of its coverage, the areas that are covered by this reconfiguration, but that did not include any reference to the CPE. If there is such an idea, maybe so, it's still coming, but we haven't encountered it as yet, and that's the official position. But I just want to say, whether DPE continues to exist or doesn't continue, to the extent that the state maintains ownership of companies, this function will remain important. Whether it is exercised by ourselves or exercised by the different departments, the exercise of shareholder oversight will remain. DPE may not be there, but that function, I don't see that function will go away. Number one. Number two, what sets the Department of Public Enterprises apart from the other departments is that this is the only thing that we do, shareholder oversight. Getting close to the companies, understanding what they do, understanding their challenges, understanding their requirements, is our daily bread. And the skills that we put behind nobody else in government has the skills that we put behind that function. In fact, as we speak, there are departments that have companies that tend to us for advice. We are the internal consultant in government on shareholder oversight. Because this is the only thing that we do. Other departments do this, and then they do policy. They don't do this very well, but they also do policy. They also do service delivery. They do many things, and this function actually sometimes suffers in those departments. I once met the chairman of the board of a company that is not within the PPE, who said that they had not had a meeting with the minister. They've not had a meeting with their minister. So I asked, so where do you get your direction from? Who directs you? How do you do the things that you're doing? How do you choose the things that you're doing? They choose them themselves. And
And the quality of oversight, if it's poor, is associated with all kinds of practices, corruption and, you know, nepotism and that type of thing. So don't underestimate the importance of this function. And then, as I said again, you know, if it's not in DPE, it nevertheless remains important. I just want to say on a lighter note that I heard that ESCOM might go to the energy, Transnet might go to Department of Transport, and DNL is Department of Defense and so on. But nobody said what DPE is going to go to. Honorable Michaels, your observations are spot on around the impact of a strike on Mutupi. That's spot on. Because there were labor unrest was one of three major causes of the delay. And so we have brought the other two problems under control. You know, the welding work has been, they've caught up with that. The controller instrumentation problems, they've caught up with that. On labor, incidentally, and I want to tie this up with a comment of the honorable member from the EFF. On labor, the module that was used on labor was a problematic one, because ESCOM is a project owner. The work is conducted by contractors. They are responsible for employment. So those employees are not ESCOM's employees. They are employees of the companies, the contractor companies. However, the mistake that ESCOM made was to be hands-off. To say, no, we are not going to get involved. These are not our workers and so on. Because when they did that, the companies put in place a labor dispensation that in fact was a carving out, a carved out from our labor laws. With the effect that the workers, in terms of those agreements, had less rights than they were entitled to. And so, while they signed on to these agreements, it was iniquitous. So that's why labor instability was always a frequent thing, because they asked the workers to suspend their rights. So we came in then and intervened and said to ESCOM, you must go in there as well. You must go in and ensure that these companies comply with our labor laws. And so after many months of negotiation, we got an agreement. What do they call an agreement? The partnership agreement that committed all the parties to ensuring that the project is delivered on time and that problems when they arise are resolved timely, effectively, and in accordance with the law, the provisions of the law, as it were. We were hoping by putting in place something like that, which is aligned with the law, is probably best practice. We would achieve the labor stability. Sadly, it does not appear that we are. And insofar as NUMSA, the court has found against NUMSA, I can only say that NUMSA must take full responsibility for the problems that are going to arise as a result of the delay. I think it is completely unacceptable that when the law directs NUMSA otherwise, they choose to do something else, which in the long term is going to work against the very workers that they're supposed to be acting against in the name of. Because those contractors can lock out those workers. Because an illegal strike means the employer can what you call it, and many people that are looking for those jobs. And the same situation, by the way, I can tell you, the same situation happened at Kuha, where Nomsa and another unrecognized workers go on strike. Johnson exercises its rights, they shut out those workers. And those workers are now in a worse position. So Transnet does away with labor broking. It was about labor broking. They do away with labor broking. But Nomsa goes on strike against labor broking. And because Transnet is not using labor broking, so they're now hiring those workers directly. They're not via labor brokers. But those ones who were on strike were excluded. And now they're coming back and begging and so on and so on. You know, for Transnet to take them back. So we're seeing a form of unionism that is counterproductive. Unions have been part of the liberation of this country, and they've been progressive. And they've dealt with issues. We've created all kinds of frameworks, the legislation, the tools for resolving disputes are there. There's not a shortage of those tools. But this new form of unionism chooses to ignore, to bypass those things, and pursue actions that one can only conclude are not in the best interest of workers. This is a political problem that the leaders of our country must address. It's not going to be possible for ESCOM alone to deal with this issue. It is not going to be possible for the department alone to deal with this issue. It requires a proper response to deal with it. I am not sure which AG report you are referring to. Was it the report on the annual performance of the department? If I recall, it was 68. We achieved 68% of our targets. And you're right, that's underperformance. That's underperformance. The norm, if you have performed, you must perform to 80%. That's the norm. You've performed if you've achieved 80% of your targets. And so I want to take that at face value and accept that. But actually, when we started to get into this with the AG, we found that there were technical problems about how you prove to the AG you have performed. There were certain areas of ambiguity. There were certain areas, I'll give you an example, where we say as a performance indicator, we will have a signed shareholder compact. Okay, it's a performance indicator. So the shareholder compact is done. The department has done that. A signed performance agreement, who will sign it? So you sign it, it's signed and done if it's a minister. But the department has done this, a table to the minister. I have signed it as the head of the department, but it's with the minister. Now, sometimes I'm successful to influence the minister to do things on time, sometimes I'm not. But the AG comes and says, no, we can see this, but the department has not performed because the minister has not signed it. So there were issues of interpretation like that. Actually, in fact, just to shock you, the AG, we started off the AG saying we have only performed 32%. So we went through this process and so on with the AG, and we managed to up it to 68. We could have still gone higher because I personally knew that the department has performed. As I say, you know, these are serious professionals who take themselves seriously. If they take them seriously, they can't look, you know, sit on their jobs. You know, so I'm satisfied about the work ethic as a head of the department. But I thought to ask the HL, we suppose, again, we can give up now. You know, it's not, you cannot invest. You it's very hard to change. One PhD is made an opinion. This is very hard to change the HG's opinion. The fact that we were able to get the HG to change from 32 to 38. So it was a special year, in a sense, because as you will see, it is out of the norm with the previous years and this year, because this year we've done 80 units. We've performed up to 80%. Many departments were caught like this. We were not the only ones, because the AG is beginning to audit performance information. Previously, the AG looked at financial information, but now they're doing performance. And if you, how you've outlined your work and the indicators you've used, you have not thought through carefully, you're going to get caught. And that sometimes does not mean that you haven't done the work. But I take the point, and I concede that from an onlooker, yeah, it would be a matter of concern. I've dealt with your issue around the DPE and the PLC review. Now, the PLC review is concluded, and to my knowledge, it's a public document. It is a public document, so anybody can. Yes, it is a public document. Which I'm sure we can organize that the members of the committee have access to it as such. What remains is how those recommendations are going to be implemented. In the previous cabinet, the president had appointed a team of ministers. Now, some of them have changed roles. So I don't know what's going to happen, and I think that may be something, Chairperson, which I would advise that the committee may consider directly inviting the presidency to brief you on, and I know that they're very keen to do so. In fact, I think they did brief the previous committee. So the issue is still relevant. They can be invited to brief the new committee. Because I believe, and that's going to help me deal with another issue, another question that has been raised. It is the most far-reaching, comprehensive review that has relied on an analysis and benchmarks of state-owned companies all over the world. That's report. So it's a high quality report. We made a lot of contributions to it. It proposes, amongst others, that the state has to go through each state-owned company and ask the question: is it useful? Is it making a contribution? Can it be self-financing? If it cannot be self-financing, does the fiscals have the capacity to finance, to fund it? Or should it be disposed of? Or should a private partnership, that type of model, be explored? So the options are there. So all you need to do is to take those options, that template, and put it on each of the companies and see what's on balance of issues and balance of evidence, which way to go. So it is proposing a pragmatic approach as opposed to an ideological approach that says the states must own all of the companies and own them 100%. And therefore, to the extent that we are going to process the PLC's recommendations, it will enable us to achieve policy clarity on the issues that you are raising, Chair. And it will enable us, I, I, sometimes it's better to come at these things not from the use of scary words like privatization, but to say, you know, can the private sector come and assist whilst the state still maintains control? You have a different discussion, I think, if you come at it in that way. And in any case, if I observe the policies of all of the parties, even the ruling party does envisage that the private sector has a role to play in the sectors of the economy where the state watches. So it's not a policy issue, but it's rather the models we use to implement and to start to explore this. Because the reality is that that question confronts us now as we speak. Because the Treasury does not have the capacity to fund or put in money, capitalize some of the assets, some of the big owned companies, especially the ones in DP, but I know others as well, you know, that are all in need of what you call it. So it's almost a moot point. Your issue is a very moot in that sense, Chair. And this has been the new administration. One does not want to prejudge how things are going to go, but I think these are matters that are confronting this administration as it starts, given our ambitions in regard to investment in infrastructure and all of that. I think this is probably an important, the most important issue that has arisen in our discussion today. The GSM Act, the department did work on this many years ago, certainly over 5 years ago, to look at how you define state ownership and the parameters and the protocols around all of these issues, including how you finance them and that type of thing. At the same time, however, the Treasury was doing a legislation to review the PFMA Act at the time. And then DGI was also doing legislation in the same space, the Companies Act. You know, I was the Director General of DGI at the time. And each of these three separate pieces of legislation dealt with more or less the same concern. Then the cabinet at the time, we all went, DPE went, DGI went, Treasury went. The cabinet says, hold on. You need to go and coordinate. So we were all sent back to coordinate. I think that that coordination has escaped us. But the Companies Act proceeded because it was economy-wide. It covered both state-owned companies and the private sector, and we could not allow a vacuum in the governance of private companies whilst we in the state are still trying to find each other. So we proceeded to pass the Companies Act. But the issue around how you deal with ownership in the state and how you harmonize approaches still remains, as it were. So the PRC report deals with it and actually supports the idea of legislation. So it's got that history. You asked about what are the issues around state-owned companies. Are they funding issues? Are they capacity issues? Or is it oversight? I must say, if I just talk about oversight, the department has developed tools that are standard and best practice tools for shareholder oversight. Sometimes we are successful in applying those tools, sometimes we're not. and sometimes the posture of the minister in place depends whether we succeed. Sometimes it's associated with other outcomes as it were. So it's really complicated like that. You know. I think on the oversight front, I think we've done very well. There's still room to improve, clearly. But I would not say that the problems around our state-owned companies have a lot to do with that. I think they have to do with a range of factors. Let me just take the airlines, for example. The airlines are operating in a highly competitive environment. And we, South Africa, being a country that is so far from the major destinations that we fly to, are vulnerable to shifts in the input cost of the business. And the largest input cost is fuel. So a small shift in fuel price, a small shift in exchange rate, means a difference between whether SAA is profitable or not. They'll tell you, for example, in the last financial year, had the price of fuel not moved in the way that it did, they would have made a profit. So that shift cost them about 2 billion rand, you know, shift in the price of what you call it. So sometimes you have a double whammy of exchange rate and price of fuel. First thing. Second thing, the aircraft are old, so they're fuel inefficient. So they have to use much more fuel efficient aircraft. They must refleet, because the rest of the airlines probably are refleeting and going into new technologies and that type of thing. Those are factors pretty much out of the hands of the company, out of control of the company, that are negatively influencing the company. There are things which are within the company's control that could help. The governance issues, clearly. On the governance issues, sometimes we succeed in putting good boards, good executives. Sometimes we don't succeed. I would suggest that it's an area now that we are going to have to look at very carefully. Because when you are operating in a challenged environment, such as our companies in the aviation sector, it may require that the people that are at the helm are quality people that can assist and not make things worse. So you're asking a very important question, and I know I'm not answering you with a yes or no, but one has to understand every company and to see what are the factors that are at play. And I'm hoping, as if we do what the chair is suggesting, that we zoom in on each of these companies, it'll become apparent, you know, what are the real issues that are at each instance. The strategy for leveraging procurement, yes, we do. We started a program which was very much inspired by the fact that when Transnet and Eskom started to build new capacity to launch these new projects, because they come from a history where they were told not to invest anymore. So they lost the skills. They lost capital project management skills. They also lost the skills to build power plants. So the department then started to say, no, you need to put in place programs for skills development. But more than that, we must also look as the industries that could support this, these projects. Some of them died over the years when we didn't build any infrastructure. But some of them are there. You can support them to become competitive and to then supply into, what you call it. And these companies, they went out to the market to identify the companies, and they're working with those companies, supporting them to be able to come to the level where they can meet the requirements of the original equipment manufacturers, which is your Alstom's, General Electric, and that type of thing. So this program is called the Competitive Supply Development Program, which we will have an opportunity again to get into. It's very, very successful. And now we're monitoring, we are now putting it on the shareholder compact as a key performance area on which we monitor the companies. Billions of rands are being spent on these companies to bring them up to speed and help them to employ more people. Because this deals with the contribution, the question around the contribution of the state-owned companies to jobs. This is the way they're going to do it. They're going to contribute to economic growth when they expand the base of entrepreneurship in the economy through promoting small, medium enterprises that can employ more people. That's one of their contributions. But of course, their contribution is also because when there's electricity, people will invest. There are investors who might want to come invest in mining, but they hear that the South Africa has got a shortage of electricity, they won't come. Or South Africa has got a shortage of rail capacity, they won't come. So that's another way. The services that they provide stimulate investment, and that's also the way they contribute to the economy. So it's both directly and indirectly. But again, we can get deeper into the analysis around these things so that we are on the same page with the community. Simpila, I want you to deal with the question of substations. But on skills, the skills program says, start off saying, you develop the skills for yourselves, for your requirements, but now we're forcing them to develop skills for the economy. So they are training more than they need for themselves. It's not a bad thing because those people get absorbed in the economy. I can tell you, I have the same thing. Sometimes when I lose my professionals, I cry. I say, hey, you know, it's terrible. But someone else gains. The economy as well. As a whole gains. If they were going abroad, then to go and develop other economies, then I'd be worried. But if they stay within the country, they work elsewhere, it's okay. So state-owned companies train for more than they require, which is good, because these skills, the economy needs these skills. There's a demand for these skills in the economy, and so we benefit it. So it's not necessarily a zero-sum game. So Pierre will deal with the substations, COO will deal with the gender balance, I'll say something later on about spending on consultants, and I'll talk about the SWOT, what the thinking was in the SWOT. Someone said PPE needs to crack the whip. It's an honourable thing. Yes, we have to. We are expected to crack the whip, and we will continue to crack the whip. If the boss does not perform, we should fire the board. Because if my officials don't reform. I must fire them. Because if I don't fire them, then I can be sure that I'm not going to be able to achieve. It's a very simple idea. So if you have a dysfunctional board, it's not good for the company. I think everybody's common sense. Everybody can see this. Let's deal with some of those as I've distributed them, and then we'll see what remains, and I can come and sweep up those that remain.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. In relation to the whether there are adequate substations in the country to take up of demand, and whether it's an issue of maintenance, it's actually both. There was a study done by the EDI Holdings in 2008 that identified the fact that there's not enough substations, but also there's a huge backlog in terms of the maintenance and the refurbishment of the networks and the substations. And we haven't, addressed the problem, not only Eskom, but particularly the municipalities and the municipal distributors. So it's one of the issues that the Department of Energy has identified in terms of the medium-term strategic framework as a matter to resolve. So there's an issue of funding. How do you fund the upgrading of those substations and dealing with the maintenance issues? It hasn't been resolved yet. I mean, it's one of the issues that has to be resolved. Either you fund it through the tariff, or it has to be funding from the fiscal. But the answer is no. There's not enough and adequate substations, and it's not adequately maintained.
Just on that, the answer, or some part of it, is that there's an agreement between Energy, Department of Energy, and Department, I think it's Land Bank.
DBSA,
yeah, Development Bank, for the rollout of substations, which municipalities had to fund it before,
yes.
And the money never got to municipalities. And municipalities have to use from the operating and capital budgets.
Yeah.
But now that agreement is in, also coupled to that, what does DPE role in terms of oversight into that agreement? Because people are not blaming the Department of Energy. They are blaming DPE.
Yeah.
They are blaming Eskom and DPE. You see, because they think all substations is with Eskom. And all substation and Eskom reports to DPE. So that's why I say that although you guys are not supposed to take the blows, but people give the blows to you. You see? Like this now with substation. Now the member says, why? What is the problem with substations to you? So just give us that little bit of background and that correlation, because my energy must now produce to the municipalities the needs analysis, and where there's substations, let's look at KSD municipalities. They're supposed to have built three substations, and the money has been allocated in all this, and no substations have been built. People are now blaming Eskom and DPE. Says, hey, DPE, where is the substations? But Energy is sitting like arms folded to say, no, wait, let them fight with Eskom and DPE. You see, so what role do you, is the interdepartmental relations framework that you have built up with Energy to talk, to say, but guys, you are not performing, and we must take the blame for you.
Yeah.
Also with the free basic service, people are looking at you. With the rollout of the free basic, they don't understand. So I'm going to say in Cape Town, the city of Cape Town is responsible for the electricity rollout as a metro municipality. But people are blaming Eskom. They say, no, Eskom. And Eskom is under the stable of DPE. So please, sorry, I've given you a mouthful now. But
No, thank you, Chair. And you're right. It's a correct observation that there's dual role within the municipal environment. There are areas that are supplied by Eskom, and then there are areas that are supplied by municipalities.
maybe just to make an example, yesterday I had to take a cold shower in the morning because I didn't have power in St. Jude, and it's supplied by Tuane. And the substation blew up, so they didn't have power for some like 2 days. We do work with the Department of Energy, but you know we work with them in as far as Eskom is concerned. We do raise these issues around the role of municipalities and the capacity of municipalities. In fact, we even requested Eskom to assist the municipalities because there's an issue of capacity and capability as well within the municipalities. So you can resolve the money issues, but if you don't have capacity to do some of those things, it becomes an issue as well. So we do work with them, and we do identify, you know, the hotspots around the country where Eskom can make certain resources available to go and assist. Because Eskom also has an interest. I mean, some of these municipalities buy from Eskom, so if they cannot distribute, it means there's no revenue for Eskom. So there is that relationship that has been built with the Department of Energy, the National Treasury, and the DPSA to resolve some of those issues.
We need to, because the room has been booked for 4:30. And you know, with Parliament, if you book to 4:30, you can go 10 minutes early. Not Eskom, but Parliament cuts off everything.
I think
because there is also study groups taking place in these venues, you know, after we.
Yeah.
But look, DG, as we said, our focus point is that we deal with the budget now. Issues emanating from the budget, because we have to have as much as possible sessions with you, and we need to have another session before the
23rd,
before the 23rd. We need to have another session with the department, with you and the department. It is critically important that we do that. So if we can just deal with the budget issues today and in our next session as well, because we will be going on the oversight strategic planning sessions.
Yeah.
If there's any other critical questions that you want to answer quickly from the budget cycle.
No, Chair. No, I'm checking. I didn't hear that there was a specific question asked on the budget. What was it? All consultants. This used to be a problem in the department, but it's not my impression that it is in the way that it was before, because we've tried to discipline it. Because in any case, I could not say to Treasury, give me money to employ more people to do the work. But at the same time, go to Treasury and say, give me money to use more consultants. Okay. So the use of consultants was at a time when the department did not have the resources, as it were. Did not have the skills, as it were. And so they depended on consultants. And by the way, you know, the first time I went to the Treasury, and when they were resisting giving me money to expand the establishment of the department, they said to me, why don't you use consultants? We can give you money to use consultants. So I said, yeah, it's fine, you know, it's okay, you can give me money to use consultants, but the consultants give me a report. So I take the report, but somebody else must interpret this report and analyze and say, you know, you see, so what's the point of having a report of consultants that I don't understand? You know. So we've tried to rebalance and we've scaled down on the use of consultants. But I must say that we will still have to use consultants in certain circumscribed, specialized areas where I don't have the skills. Say, financial engineering of let's
once-off gender studies, pay for it. But give it to my officials, because when we then unpack the interventions that are required from that advice, somebody has to can do them. So there's a correlation between what you go for consultancies and how you optimize that. Many departments get consultants reports that they file because nobody can understand that, and so on, and the consultants get their money and they go enjoy themselves, and we don't solve a problem. So it's good. It's a good issue to look at, and we would like to be as accountable as we can be on that issue. That's the one issue, Chair. Can I deal with another matter, Chair, which is not the last one we'll deal with, and then we'll take your advice that to come back for a focused engagement on a number of issues, which you will advise us what how wide or narrow you want to go for our next session. But the honourable member asked for shareholder compacts. Is it possible for the shareholder compacts to be presented to Parliament? Now, this is a long-standing issue for which we need guidance. The tendency has been not to present the shareholder compacts in Parliament, because some of them, like the corporate plans, contain sensitive proprietary information of the company. So if we come here and we present this, the competitors of the company have access to information that they can use, and especially for in areas where sectors that are competitive, that are competitors of our companies, like aviation. If we come and we talk about sensitive information, corporate information of SAA, yeah, your Comairs, your British Airways, and so on, will have access, and they can use that to the detriment of us. So we thought, we need to find a protocol that will allow us to share with Parliament without compromising the commercially sensitive information of the companies. I don't know what the model is, Chair, but we'll be guided by Parliament in that regard. You'd have thought perhaps in sectors where there are monopolies and so on, maybe there's no competitor. But Eskom is no longer a monopoly. The IPPs are competitors of Eskom. So, anyway.
The Honourable Moratella.
Yeah, my apologies. Maybe I didn't get the response from the DG. It might have just slipped my mind. The issue around bailout and all of that on the part of Eskom. I didn't hear DG say something about that. Thanks.
Let me deal quickly with that issue. I think the use of the word bailout sometimes is associated with some emotion of sorts, and it's the description of a hopeless situation. Eskom is not in that situation. Actually, Eskom in the last financial year made a profit. So it's a profitable company. Transnet is a profitable company. Transnet's results were out this week. Everybody saw. They made it for the first time, they made a profit in excess of 5 billion rand. So these companies, in terms of the businesses that they run, are viable. However, it does occur for a number of reasons that in the case of Eskom, there is a kind of a structural problem with the business model of the company. And here is what it is. When Eskom asked for 16% tariff, they wanted to ensure that that will cover them for the cost of producing electricity. The cost of producing electricity and the cost of the infrastructure rollout that the power stations that they are building in terms of the loans, that paying back the loans that they owe, and that was the model. None of that was modeled in that 16%. They didn't get that, which means that they have a hole that has got to be plugged. So as we speak, Eskom, the price of electricity that Eskom charges does not reflect the cost. It's less than what it costs Eskom. People pay Eskom for electricity less than what it costs Eskom to produce electricity. And many years ago, it was agreed that electricity prices have to be cost reflective. But that issue is in the hands of the Department of Energy. It's their policy, their legislation. They did not implement that. That has not been implemented. And that thing is coming back to catch up with Eskom. That's where their financial problems are coming from. They're also coming from the fact that there's a downturn in the economy, so the demand for electricity is lower. So their revenues are lower as well, lower than the projection, lower than what was projected when they asked for the 16%. So those are the factors that are creating a problem. It's not a hopeless situation, as in a company that's badly run, mismanages the business, and gets himself into trouble. Eskom is a well-run company, but they need government support, because they are being expected to do quite a lot. Let me leave that and say the IPPs, on the other hand, which is the private sector, they get what they want. They get a return. They get a fair return on their investment. So Eskom buys electricity from IPPs at full cost, plus profit, but it's not allowed to sell on the same basis. What it means, Eskom is subsidizing the IPPs. That's not optimal. And we in the Department of Energy will have to come back and deal with this thing. In fact, there is a meeting that the two ministers are meant to have in this week, if it succeeds, and we hope in that meeting to put these issues on the table, that are going to help to create a supportive environment for Eskom. Thank you.
Thank you, G. That is where the stuck is with the Eskom, because you can't cut your nose to spite your face. You understand? In the IPPs is independent power producers. So if a member doesn't want to be a member of parliament anymore, he can open up a power producing plant and sell back to the grid. Plus, you sell back to the grid at a discount price, and government pays you for selling to them. So that is really the Eskom model. But be that as it may, personally I've got a strong view that in the world, you could see what happened in the Middle East. You could see what happens in Britain. If we as a government doesn't have the political will to support our state-owned companies, we must not look at the budget of SAA. It's our national carrier. We need to be proud of it. We need to say to SAA, there's 50 billion, go and renew your fleet. That's the same what the United Arab Emirates are doing. They say Qatar Airlines, Emirates, come here. There is so much money, go and renew so that you can make money to be profitable. And that is what, if we want our SOEs to be profitable, PG, and our SOCs to be profitable. I think part of our commitment, and what I always say, is that as a department and committee, we need to work together with each other, and as the ministers as well. We are not the enemies, you are not our enemies, we are not your enemies, because if you fail, we fail. If you succeed, we succeed. And that is what I think this committee will strive to do, is to work together, let's take hands together and use the slogan together, together, we can move South Africa free forward. We want to say also that freedom in our lifetime. Because that is what but you know, you go to
yeah.
You see, you go to Africa, they tell you, you guys are not free. Because why, forever, your state-owned companies are not making money. Let's look at the state-owned diamond company, the state-owned mining company, not making money. Because we need to have the political will to say, let's invest once and for all in SAA. Let's invest once and for all in Eskom. And then say, open it up, Eastmobile, IPPs, we open up, there we go. Now we don't give free-for-alls anymore. That's what's happening in other countries. Even in communist China, it's happening. Happening. That's why the president says radical economic transformation. And we are moving forward with that radical economic transformation. And I want to say thank you very much, DG, the members and the staff, but remember, if there's problems or what else, see it first that you've got allies in this committee that is there to cover your back, to be able to walk with you the road, give you the guidance, and we seek the guidance from you. But all we ask you as the committee is openness, fairness, and honesty. That's all we ask. And when I joined Parliament, you were the DG of DTI. You've worked well, wonderful. You were always there, always had very clean audits all the years, with no things attached. And I know you as a man that's open, honest, and that's not shy and afraid to contact members and speak to us. And for you and your staff, it's a rocky road ahead. We've got new ministers, and we need to take their hands as well and guide them, because their success is our success as well. We are not their enemies. They are our colleagues. They are our brothers, our sisters, our friends. So you've got this. In this room, we can gladly say that we are here to serve the interests of service delivery to the people of South Africa, which is also your interest, which you are doing, to see that the delivery happens on the ground. Although you are not directly, but you need to have, you are playing that headmaster role to see that the school is running smoothly. And without the headmaster, there's no order. You know, and your HODs, head of departments, I mean, all of you went to school, you know what is head of departments, and you're walking around there with the canes, although corporal punishment is out, but you must get those canes back and start whooping, walk two in a line, or walk one in a line, and all that. So let me end off by saying thank you very much, members. You are enlightened. It has been a long day. Some of our members, they are not used to Cape Town weather, so they don't know that from June up until September or August, you must use a lot of vitamin C. Unfortunately, the only one for blue and black hasn't got that vitamin C.